This is the second Train Your Brain course on awareness of the body, March 13th, 2007.
Tonight, it's really about a fundamental, foundational, psychological, and spiritual skill, awareness of the body. It's very interesting that if you look through the various spiritual traditions and contemplative practices, awareness of the body is found in a number of different ways and looked at in almost all the major religions. The body is considered as a temple. The body is as a source of beauty. The body as a repulsive object. The body as a transitory and ephemeral thing. All of those are basic truths in almost all spiritual traditions. So in terms of coming to meditation and coming to this sense of contemplation and spiritual practice, you steady the mind in concentration. You develop mindfulness of the moment-by-moment experience. You foster compassion for ourselves and others, and you nurture equanimity in the face of impermanence, old age, sickness, and death. And to do that, you start with the bodily experiences of right now, right here. In the Christian tradition, the phrase that comes to mind as I started to think about when I was writing this introduction today, the Christian tradition, the phrase comes to mind is the kingdom of God is within. Which, if you follow that, that's really essentially body awareness, looking inward. In the Buddhist tradition, the arahant, or the bodhisattva, is one who's awake and aware. And that's what the practices aim for. The awakened and aware heart-mind, fully present in both the present and the presence. And to that end, tonight we want to talk about some of the underlying neuroanatomy and neurophysiology of the experience of the moment, beginning with some basic, well-known anatomic diagrams, some of which are on the wall, some of which are in the handouts, and moving on to some of the basic principles underlying those diagrams of how the nervous system constructs an electrical representation inside that skull of the external and internal world. And that's what you experience is right here, right now. Fundamentally, one of the principles that we'll kind of be talking about is that the sensory systems differentiate sensation. And then as this moves up the spinal cord and into the brain then integrates these signals again into what it is set up to see as useful percepts and successful behaviors. It's essentially a constructed electrical reality inside your skull. And it's not what you think of when you knock your hand against the table. And what we're hoping to give you is security in the knowledge that you are a dynamic and ephemeral coalition of neurons. There truly is no there there. Nice thing to be secure in, isn't it?
It makes me warm.
Isn't it lovely? Sometimes that knowledge is uncomfortable because we like security and stability. You know, the quote that we've all remembered from our various relationships through our lives, I need to trust you, you will be there for me. Yeah. Going all the way back to childhood when we were saying it to mom and dad, and then continuing on through spouses and exes and all the rest of it. But if you stop and think about that, you've operated for most of your life with that illusion of there, capital T, being there. And maybe that's a major reason both for what's been successful in your life and also for what's been less than happy and less than successful about your life. And so knowing that there is not there could free you up to handle those unsuccessful areas of your life more skillfully. They're just as constructed. They're just as ephemeral. They're just as impermanent. And you may be able to do that with greater compassion for yourself and others, hopefully with more joy and peacefulness in the process, letting go of this sort of clutching at some really illusory, ephemeral, and vanishing security.
Yeah, Dan? Can you say more about there is no there, there, more about how you mean that?
Okay, the question for the tape recorder was that to say more about what I mean by there is no there, there. When a lot of times people have gone through and done primitive anatomy and thought, you know, that there's a homunculus in there, there's a little man, you know, somewhere, or some electrical representation of the man. And it's possible to look at some of the simple sensory systems and the way that they're projected into the brain and say, oh, there's a movie in the back of your head, you know, or there's a little guy hanging by his knees over the top of your skull that's running motor systems or perceiving sensory systems. When we actually look at the electrical processes of the brain as it is making a decision to do something, and there's a guy by the name of Wolf Singer who's done a lot of work on a process called EEG synchrony and coherence studies. And what happens is that the decision appears to manifest everywhere at once in the brain. There is a signal that sort of shows up in the brain everywhere with that the detectors are located. And so there's no single point that makes that call. The brain seems to be a manifestation of the process of the connections of the brain, not any one specific place. So there's no there where I live. There is, if for lack of a better word, there is an I-ing. You know, I seem to be a verb, or in this case, I seem to be a gerund, and I think we've said this in one of our talks. I'm doing a lot of speaking. I'm doing a lot of I-ing right now in trying to answer the question.
But tonight really is an extended answer to that question with charts and anatomical drawings, so we better keep going, but tonight really is about that overall.
Yeah.
Keep going.
So, as a kind of final introductory aside, it's important to remember and appreciate the incredible gift we've each inherited when we incarnated into this life. We got here as a species because these nervous systems that we run around inside are so incredibly successful at acting in and on the world, at understanding how to predict the consequences from actions, and in achieving deep understandings of the ultimate nature of the energy relationships in the universe. And I mean that in a quantum mechanical, you know, the energy interacting with energy of you listening to me talking. So that's the frame around tonight's picture that we're going to try to draw. And in that frame, we're going to initially talk about, since Rick and I both come from the Buddhist tradition, we're going to talk about the Buddhist classification of the five aggregates of existence. Then we're going to try to take a look at how some of the neuroanatomy and neurophysiology relates to those aggregates. And I'll try to talk about that and not have your eyes glaze over too much. Later on, we'll do some meditations related to deepening your awareness of your body, perhaps informed by some of this discussion, and appreciating it more. As a result, that you'll be able to practice increasing steadiness of mind, become more aware of that constructed, compounded nature and conditional nature of your everyday, minute-by-minute and second-by-second experience. That deepening sense of how your brain builds up a virtual reality that it seems integrated, and it's just one thing out of an actual diversity of inputs, that particular sense is really a highway, a road, lead right into lightening up about those endless changes and frustrations, the ups and downs, the gain and loss, the praise and blame. And for those who are really interested in chasing that further, it's a great aid to spiritual practice. And if you go and look at, for example, at the Buddhist suttas, that's really the main path in that the Buddha talked about. So all of this stuff is there, so you don't necessarily in the handouts, and it'll be available in the audio. There's no exam at the end of this course. There is an exam at the end of your life, but that's a different story. So if we'll be doing some experiential stuff, if you don't feel uncomfortable with that, feel free to opt out. If you feel overloaded or uncomfortable, you know, you can check out, stare at the ceiling. And please be responsible for taking care of yourself. We'll be talking about a lot of stuff that may relate to your own personal experiences. You may find some stuff coming up. This is not therapy. We don't intend, although we both are clinicians, we don't intend this to be therapy. We intend this to be essentially the beginnings of conversations in what we consider to be one of our sanghas, our communities of practitioners. And so with that, please be absolutely sure to take really good care of yourself through tonight. And I'll turn that over to Rick, who will now talk a little bit about the five aggregates.
I'm going to stand up because I just feel badly not being able to see everybody. And you might feel bad. I don't know if you feel badly about not seeing me. Okay, so I'm going to do the part that's the five aggregates. Sounds really schmancy, right? Kind of makes you want to glaze over a little bit. It's really simple. It's a map. It's a way of categorizing experience into five basic categories. And we're going to put that map together, which is kind of at the heart of Buddha Dharma. So it's kind of cool, you know, right? This is the inner scoop. We're going to put that together with real neurology, and the point being to help you be both more aware of your body and body sensations, as well as more aware of your experience in general and more at peace with it as an endlessly flowing kind of compounded movie going by. So that's the whole point. Okay, the aggregates. The aggregates were named or developed by the Buddha, so for some that has positive associations, others neutral, others unpleasant associations. I think the thing to do is to do what he said, which is never take anything on faith, but always judge it on its merits. And so you could just imagine that this was a system that happened to be created by Bob or Joan or Jane, and take it from there. Okay. So what are the aggregates? And you want to ask yourself, is it useful for me to look at my experience in this way? The first aggregate is called form. All right? And form consists of all material reality and our sensations of it. Okay? Kind of covers all material reality right there. The second aggregate is called feeling. Not emotion, but the feeling tone of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And you might notice that as your experience streams through, certain parts of it have a pleasant tone. Maybe other parts have an unpleasant tone, like the hard chair you're suddenly noticing or some irritation hanging over from something that's happened earlier today. And a lot of experience has a neutral feeling tone. But just because we don't notice a marked feeling tone doesn't mean it doesn't have one. It has a neutral feeling tone. The third aggregate is called perception. And that's the point where we just begin to categorize or label what's coming through. You know, it's very interesting to imagine looking at a picture that's out of focus on a slide projector, so you can imagine that, and then slowly turn the focusing knob till you can finally see what it is. Oh, that's a herd of Holstein cows against a dappled tree background. Suddenly, boom, we label it. Right? That moment of labeling is the moment of perception. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it's actually interesting that in the aggregate system, feeling comes before perception, and that's probably because neurologically, feeling comes before perception, because we need to jump first and think later, jump first and label later to survive. Okay. After perception comes the formations, the mental formations they're called. And these are all the contents of mind, thoughts, feelings, emotions, thoughts, emotions, desires, memories, images, psychodynamics, archetypes, etc., goals, dreams, values, political opinions, and all the rest that travel through the mind other than pure sensation, the feeling tone, and perception. And then the last aggregate is consciousness itself. Awareness, we'll be talking later about the differentiation that's fairly useful and supported by neuroanatomy of autobiographical consciousness compared to core consciousness. But if you just kind of think awareness, that's how I think about the word consciousness, which somehow seems abstract and puzzling. When I just think aware, I go, I'm aware, I'm conscious, you know. My cat is very aware, you know, he's conscious. Okay, so those are the aggregates. Not so bad, right? And so it's interesting, in the Buddhist system, it's supposed to be inclusive. You know, everything can be sorted into one of these five piles, supposedly. And see for yourself if that's true. Now, even though I'm talking about them separately, of course, they all kind of go together and they intertwine. And in any moment of experience, it often has multiple tracks running. There's the sensation track, the feeling tone, the labeling of it, our thoughts about it. Notice I've done four tracks so far. And then the awareness in which that all streams through. I actually think of awareness as, and we'll get more into this later, is, you know, the metaphor these days of a TV monitor is actually quite nice, you know, that the field of experience plays on, the stream of experience plays on the field of awareness, like pixels of light, you know, dancing on a screen, right? Just coming through, endlessly registering what's moving through it. Okay. Interestingly, the original word for the aggregates was skandhas or khandhas, and that translates, as some of you might know, as piles or heaps. All right. The idea being that the pile of feeling comprises all possible feeling tones. The pile of formations comprises all possible mental activity other than the ones already named. All right. And that term, which we like because it's kind of earthy and blunt, also has illustrates two fundamental strategies. They happen to be very Buddhist, but they also happen to be very scientific. And the first strategy is to analytically break things down to its component parts. You know, heaps of disparate elements. If you look at the progress of physics, it's been an endless drive towards smaller and smaller particles, and then simpler and simpler and more summary laws that describe the behavior of those tiny, tiny particles. Okay, that's the drive of physics. Well, if you substitute the word mind for physics, in what I just said, right, that's Buddhism and a lot of the contemplative traditions that are, you know, in parallel with it. The second thing that's illustrated by that term heaps or piles, I kind of think of like a trash pile in a certain way, or dirty socks headed for the dirty clothes, hopefully, and a pile of crumbs, what have you. But anyway, is that it's not very flattering, is it? This is not a self-flattering, self-congratulatory approach. It's very scientific. It's kind of just the facts, man, right? What's up? And there is a certain disenchanted, distanced stance toward the elements of experience that is, I think, very useful in terms of detaching from the flow of experience, not taking it so seriously, and ultimately becoming increasingly free relative to it, all right? Okay. So let's see, moving along, as you can see, these elements compound experience. If you just kind of imagine your experience right here, and that's what it's interesting to do when I'm speaking, is to go back and forth between this way of looking at experience into the experiences you're having, you know, right now. Just the sound of my fingers and the associations to that and what stirs up inside you is a stream of experience, all right? In this model, which is very supported by the neuroanatomy, which Rick will talk about in a moment, there's the notion that essentially all of experience is comprised of elements or parts. To put it a little differently, the flow of information, particularly pertaining to conscious awareness in the brain, in other words, the flow of neurological activity and information that is one-to-one with it, can also be categorized in one or more of these five ways. All right. Now that's kind of a top-down view. A bottom-up view is to think of these little elements or nuggets of experience as building blocks out of which experience is constructed or compounded. In other words, if you were to think about classes of things that you could make a batch of cookies with, right? You have the flour, the sweetener, the egg, the liquid, what else? And the candy, the chocolate chips, of course, very important. To go on that batch of cookies, right? You could, when you're done, you got a cookie, right? But you could say, well, that is a cookie, but that word cookie even is what? It's a perception, it's a label. But you can look more closely and see that that cookie is comprised of many, many component elements, and even those component elements are comprised of smaller and smaller pieces, you know. And so there's this, that's why we talk about basically that experience itself is constructed. What's also interesting, too, just to think about it, is that, just as a small point that I like, is that the relentlessly deconstructive approach. I don't know how many of you have any familiarity with Buddhism or, you know, meditation or what have you, but it's a relentlessly deconstructive approach based on discourses 2,500 years old that are enormously postmodern. Isn't that interesting? This teasing apart of the elements into the tinier and tinier parts. Okay. So why should we care? Right? What good does it do to regard experience in this way? Well, for ourselves and for lots of people, maybe including some of the people in the room, this has actually been really useful as a method for suffering less and being happier and more peaceful and, frankly, a better person, speaking for myself. Why is that? It's that these elements, these aggregates, as is traditionally stated, are subject to clinging. They are the elements of experience that we cling to. We cling to certain sensations. Clinging, by the way, comprises or includes both pursuing and resisting. Both are forms of clinging. You know, when we resist, we're in effect, we're clinging to the alternative. And often we're actually sort of stuck to that which we're resisting. Right? So the point being that we cling to sensation, we cling to the pleasant feeling tone, we resist the unpleasant. We cling to perceptions of things. We want it to look a certain way. You know, there's a term in psychology called cognitive dissonance where we tend to resist new information that violates our pre-existing perceptions. We cling to certain thoughts and feelings. We want them to continue. We don't like other thoughts or feelings. And, of course, we kind of fundamentally cling to consciousness in the sense that we don't want it to end. You know, whether it's a little child who doesn't want to fall asleep or, you know, a 90-year-old who doesn't want to die, right? We hold on to consciousness, too. Now, what's the problem with clinging? Clinging, there's a place for it. I'm a serious rock climber. Although my days are past, I've clung to really tiny things desperately, and I'm here to tell the tale. Having said that, a lot of clinging goes right to suffering, does it not? You can see for yourself. Does so in multiple ways. One, it's inherently unpleasant. It's kind of stressful. It's tense. It's there's a little uptightness just to clinging, per se. Second, if we try to pursue that which is always changing, and that's the nature of both reality and experience, there's a frustration there, right? Third, if we try to hold on, because we like it, to what's also changing, it's sort of disappointing. Okay, it's always slipping through our fingers. There we are at the lip of the waterfall of now. Isn't that interesting? That what just happened a second ago will never come back. It's gone. Here we are at the lip of the now, the moment, always grabbing at what's already gone over the edge because we want it to hold on, you know, keep it, right? Or stop what's streaming toward us. Right there is a veil of tears. And then last, an attitude of resisting the nature of reality, whether it's the reality of our internal subjective experience or the reality objectively, let's say, that's out there, including who sits in the White House or who you know, is dating our daughter or our son's lack of motivation in college. Might be speaking personally there. Things like that, you know, then kind of, we're in trouble because resistance is sort of stressful, tense, and unpleasant, right? It also has a kind of aggressive quality to it. Obviously, that kind of suffering resistance is different from taking a moral stand for what matters and what we care about. Okay, so you can see how clinging, you know, to any of the aggregates is an immediate pathway to suffering. And obviously there's an invitation here to see for yourself. Is this true for you in your own experience? And what gets really powerful is to observe this process more and more granularly. In other words, on a shorter and shorter time scale. Oftentimes, you know, kind of when we start out in sort of a self-awareness or personal growth, we have one insight. And that's the first insight we've ever had, you know, one in a decade. Then, right, then we start having maybe one insight a year, then one a month, then one a day, then one an hour. You know, people who are really far along, they're continually aware of this dynamic, right? And so we can kind of progress in that direction. Okay. Now, one of the major forms of clinging is clinging to self, right? That's a particular category of clinging and one of the most painful or fraught with suffering. And, you know, that's where we basically take things personally. Now, we are definitely going to talk more about self, the there that isn't there, you know, et cetera, in future classes. That's a rabbit hole that everybody wants to go down, and Rick and I would love to go down, and we're going to try to avoid that form of greed and craving, all right, and lust. We won't try to hold back on that one. Nonetheless, I will make two quick points, okay? First point is that identification with or appropriation of any of the aggregates goes right to self. And one thing you can do for yourself, a useful fiction, is to observe that process from time to time, or even fairly continually. Maybe when you're meditating or just sitting on a bus, or you know, you're at Aunt Sue's you know, birthday gathering and bored to tears, and rather than being bored, you just decide to observe the flow of experience with interest and all the rest. You can observe appropriation and identification, and that's pretty useful. The other thing I will say is that when the aggregates change, as they always do, to the extent that we've appropriated them or identified with them as self, that tends to be disturbing. It makes us uneasy. I think that's actually one of the sources of the sort of background anxiety that is unpleasant, yet which has had a lot of survival value, you know, over millions and millions of years. So evolution has put up with, self has been useful to, from an evolutionary standpoint, for multiple reasons. I think one of those reasons is that self is scared a lot. You know, there's a lot about selfing that is provocative of fear. And that fear has helped us pass on our genes to our grandchildren, right? Which is one of the reasons I think that it's been, that evolution has put up with it. But on the other hand, just because it's led to grandchildren in times past, you know, doesn't mean that we ourselves can't be wise with regard to our own self. Okay. Now, what's the alternative? It's our ignorance that keeps us tied to the aggregates. You know, the traditional metaphor is a dog tied to a post who runs around the post, right? Maybe its leash lets it go round and round, but it never breaks free. It's ignorance. And there are three fundamental kinds of ignorance about the aggregates. One, we tend to be in delusion that they're permanent. They're endlessly impermanent. We tend to be in illusion or have a delusion that they're permanent. And they may last a long time. El Capitan will last a long time, but nothing's permanent. I mean, for me, you've heard me say this, it's one of the more mind-blowing facts that I've come across as an astronomy junkie, that in about 4 billion years, our sun is going to become a red giant. It's going to slowly expand, and it's going to swallow Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Maybe get out to the asteroids. And then all this will be gone. Now, it's 4 billion years from now, okay, but it's all going to be gone. Blew my mind the other day to read that Hawaii is going to be under the Pacific Ocean in about 80 million years. All right? Now, that may, my point is that's a larger time scale, but on a shorter time scale, have we noticed? There's a certain amount of gray hair in the room. You know, I had a poignant moment this morning looking at a photo of our two kids taken at my sister's wedding just 10 years ago. Wow. So little, so sweet, so precious. You know what I mean? Now, so big, so gainly, but they can drive. They're pluses. Okay, so moving along.
Till your insurance bill
comes. That's it, that's it. Oh, well, I don't know, whatever. Okay, the other one is that the aggregates are a source of true happiness. Well, they're a source of pleasant. I mean, I like glazed donuts, right? Wouldn't you rather have a good latte or than a bad one? Or, you know, watch a good movie rather than a bad one? Okay, fine. It's kind of neat to put on nice clothes or see neat things. But in terms of lasting, profound happiness, you know, I think the mark of maturity is to realize that the sources aren't out there in terms of lasting happiness. And then last, the last illusion is that the aggregates comprise itself. And as we've argued a little tonight and we'll argue a lot in later classes, the aggregates really don't comprise itself. Okay. So what's the alternative? And I'm moving to a close now. The alternative is to be amused, to be interested, be compassionate toward the aggregates, but don't be caught. The dog is caught at the post. You know, if we can simply have a growing, increasing knowledge of the aggregates streaming through, knowledge that is at first perhaps intellectual, but then grows with time and becomes more and more experiential, we don't take them so seriously. We do the best we can. We tend to the causes. We water the fruit tree as best we can so that the aggregates that stream through are as pleasant and benign and wholesome and benevolent as possible. All right. But we don't take them too seriously. We don't clutch at them. We endlessly let go. We observe them like a movie on a screen rather than being up on the screen and identifying with the movie ourselves and thinking that we ourselves are with Bruce Willis in Die Hard 4. All right? Oh, no worries.
I'm sorry.
No, no. I'm surprised we haven't had more cell phones going off. Okay. So let's see, where are we here? Okay.
Compelled.
So I'm about done. In sum, I'll say this, and I'll speak personally. You know, for me, there's been a growing and very happy capacity to, first of all, see everything you're aware of, everything we're aware of, as compounded, as developed from many, many elements, including the sounds. You know, isn't that interesting, right? It's just streaming through. It's a stimulus coming by. Notice the reactions to it? Pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Then just imagine all the reactions Iris is having. She's like having our reactions on steroids. Right? Oh my God, I'm so... Right? And yet, what was happening there? It was just a sound.
Right? How many mental formations per second? Right?
Yeah. But we add all these reactions to the event itself. So, and those reactions are compounded. They're just constructed. Think of the history. Think of all the little, if you have self-awareness, that's where self-awareness comes in. Because you can see more and more of the elements that go into reactions. Our history, bells, our training. You know, some of us were probably trained in environments where, you know, when the bell went off, you had to really stiffen up. Others more laid back, whatever, you know, that gets in the mix. All kinds of stuff gets in the mix, right, in our reactions. And seeing those compounded elements helps us be less and less controlled by our reactions, right? We have them, but we are not them. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that these aggregates streaming through are fundamentally unsatisfying. That was the Buddhist term, and that's certainly my experience, and I think it's a person's experience more and more. They're enjoyable, they're to be enjoyed, but they don't ultimately feed us. You know, I find that people turn to spiritual life in one form or another, typically at one of two moments. Things are horrible or things are really good, you know. Horrible is easy to explain. It's when things are really good for a while that people often turn to spiritual life because they have a sense, this is really good. But you know, there's really something missing. I have a feeling of there's something more, or there's something that just doesn't scratch that itch all the way down deep, right? So that's the second thing. And the third orientation to the aggregates is that they're non-binding. That's great. We can be free of them. They're not binding. They're arbitrary. They're created by causes that preceded them. They will disappear. They stream through the field of awareness. The TV monitor itself is never fundamentally sullied or harmed by the content of the movie going through. It could be a horror film. It could be Beauty and the Beast. It could be, you know, your favorite movie of all time. It doesn't matter. The screen is never harmed or touched, you know. The aggregates do not have to be binding. And all that together, an awareness of them is compounded, a sense of them is ultimately unsatisfying, and an orientation to them that's free, that they're not inherently binding, is really good news. So now it's Rick's turn. Any questions so far? From somebody else first.
Yeah.
All right, Daniel.
So I'm curious about how you're distinguishing feeling from emotion.
Sure. The question is how to distinguish feeling from emotion. Feeling has to do with the what, as a psychologist, you'd recognize as the hedonic tone. Hedonism, pleasure. Is it pleasant or unpleasant or neutral? Emotion is the territory people think of as affect. You know, sadness, fear, joy, shame, anger, delight, surprise, disgust, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And you can realize that an emotion might have a pleasant or unpleasant feeling tone. In other words, sometimes doesn't it feel pleasant to be pissed off in a weird way? Other times, doesn't it feel unpleasant to be pissed off? Similarly, it could feel pleasant sometimes in a bittersweet way to be sad. Mm-hmm. Looking at that picture of my kids was a pleasant kind of sorrow for me, and so forth. Okay. Other questions or comments? Yes?
This idea of neutrality in feeling, just from some reading and across a Harvard researcher who did some research about the fact that we always judge things, and it's pretty hard to stay neutral. I mean, isn't that a skill that's developed, and is that kind of related to the whole idea of meditation, of trying to be neutral within our mental state, because we're always judging things, we're always kind of thinking about things being positive or negative, pain or pleasure, pleasant or unpleasant?
That's a great question. So she asked, if I could do justice to your question, is it not true that we tend to always relate to things as, you know, or want to as, you know, pleasant or unpleasant, you know, positively or negatively? And is not the goal of meditation, if you will, to be neutral about experience? Okay. And what I would say, and Rick obviously may chime in, is that first, there is a tendency, obviously, to relate to experience as pleasant or unpleasant because that's where the survival value is,
yeah.
Right? We want to eat or mate with the pleasant, and we want to, you know, fight or flee from or, you know, freeze with regard to or appease with regard to the unpleasant. All right. On the other hand, you can observe in your own experience, there's a lot that's neutral. There's a lot that's neutral. And because it doesn't have the same survival value, the mind tends to scoot right by it. But that automatic tendency can be countermanded with a little conscious intention. And by observing the neutral, and I would actually really underline this if I could, by observing the neutral in reality out there and in the flow of experience and getting comfortable with the neutral, that is a great way to undermine the automatic tendency to be greedy and grasping after the pleasant, to the degree that's not so good for ourselves and others, or to deal with the tendency to resist or quarrel with the unpleasant. In other words, by being more and more aware of the neutral, that helps us do that. That's point one. Point two, I would not say that I think the primary aim, certainly of Buddhist spiritual practice, and there are many contemplative disciplines and practices and so forth, but I would not say that the fundamental aim is to become neutral with regard to all experience, per se, which is a very important point. The primary aim is to become free with regard to all experience. Mm. But one of the great pathways into that freedom is to become equanimous with regard to the feeling tone. In other words, to be at peace, whether it is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Very often, we're not at peace with the neutral. We want the neutral to hurry up and get pleasant. See? Or we feel bored by the neutral or restless about it. Or, you know, we want it to move on. I mean, at the day long we did, and the slides for that are on our website, we talked a lot about stimulation hunger in the brain and how to work with that. It's just a tendency, no big deal. But the real path is, and for me it was enormously freeing. You know, calm is when we're not having any reactions. Calm is nice, but you can't guarantee calm, right? But to be equanimous with toward our reactions, whatever they are, that is a matter of earnable spiritual practice or earnable contemplative practice. Right. Did you want to add to that? Or we should probably keep moving, so maybe you, and then we'll just keep rolling.
Oh, I was just going to say that there can be simultaneously a lot of reactions rather than just one. So it can be unpleasant, it can be a dozen of them, all
right.
Opposites and yeah. All occurring at the same time.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to be neutral. You just sit there and be with it.
Right. I think the be with is a great point. And again, as a practical matter, see for yourself if it actually helps you, in a sense, to not react to your reaction.
Right.
Boy, that was wonderfully useful for me. Yeah, Rick, and then we'll move on.
One of the points we actually made, I think, maybe in the class the last time or in one of the day-longs, is the fact that one is that the your experience is a discontinuous set of pictures in the brain. There's actually states that change somewhere between 5 and 50 times a second. And so each one of those states can have its individual feeling tone. As you run through the movie and fuse that 50 frames per second into a movie, you may have all of those different feeling tones wrapped into what the brain creates the illusion of as a continuous moment. Follow me? So the brain paints this idea that this 1 second is actually a continuous arc. Well, it's actually chopped up, just like a classic movie is chopped up, you know, when you do on a frame-by-frame thing. And the second piece that I would add to that is that the states of the brain, as we're beginning to understand them, are not present or gone. They're sort of up there and available given the right circumstances. So a lot of different kinds of awareness, sensory and memory and emotions and thoughts and paradigms are continually present and then are brought to consciousness based upon some ideas of synchrony, which I'll talk a little bit about later, so that collections of neurons that are firing together become suddenly that's what you're conscious of, and then it goes back down. It's like a bubbling pot. It's the entire water is hot, but certain bubbles are popping off the surface. So the brain actually creates for us this mythology that we have several things happening at once. And what may actually be happening is that a number of discontinuous things are happening, which we've crammed into one epoch and called it this. Called it this experience of looking at my children's picture from 10 years ago, you know, that Rick brought up. Okay. So what I thought what we'd do now is a kind of a short meditation. It's going to be real short. We're running a little behind. Because we've sort of discussed the initial frame of these aggregates. And in that context, and sort of letting what Rick said kind of percolate in your head, we'd like to do an initial short meditation to kind of get an experiential idea about what's happening. So, if you can kind of get in a place where you're comfortable, take up a posture that's both relaxed and alert. Your eyes can be open, your eyes can be closed. A sense of balance, a sense of relaxed dignity. A human being, halfway between heaven and earth, seated on your chair or your cushion, right here and right now. And let your attention gradually come from all of the thoughts and memories and things that have been bouncing around into the physical sensations of the breath in your body as you're experiencing it now, in the belly, in the heart, around the nostrils, or the breath as a whole. And just be with the simple sensation of that breath, however you want to experience it. Bring yourself back again and again, returning your attention to the breath. Whatever thoughts or feelings or sensations come and go, it's all fine. See if you can become more and more absorbed in the sensation of the breath. If you find yourself elsewhere, note gently what it was that took you away. Note also that you woke up. Bring yourself back. And using that breath, once you've established it, see if you can remain aware of the aggregates just streaming through your awareness. Become aware of physical sensations, rising, lingering, passing away. Become aware of the feeling tone of these physical sensations. The sensation pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. In each moment. Become aware of perception, or the labeling or categorizing of things with each of these sensations. What are you calling it, as opposed to what it is? Watch all the other thoughts and feelings, the formations, the wants, the memories, all the images flowing through your mind. Now, quiet and centered, let yourself be aware of consciousness. Aware of awareness. So now we thought we'd schedule a short break, about 10 minutes. We'll try to keep close to time.
Oh, the bathrooms are right there. There are two right there, and there's another one down the hall. If you haven't signed in yet or offered your donation, if you want to make one, please do, and be sure to have some M&Ms. We'll see you at 10 after 8. 10 after 8.
Okay.
Welcome back. I just whispered to Rick,
stay on time.
Because if
I get on a riff.
Well, it's all of us. Let's support him because he's going to give you basically 1 year of neurology for medical students. And he promises.
He says 25 minutes.
25 minutes.
I was typing this up this morning. I was going, my God, what am I doing?
Remember that he's going to say about a third of what's in your handout. So you've got what's in your handout. You're good to go. Help us all out here by letting him do his thing, please.
Well, I must say, I was in the bathroom truly contemplating the feeling aggregate and the mixed metaphors of the pleasure and the pain. Interesting. What it's like to have a full bladder, what it's like to have an empty bladder, and the differences between them. That meditation sort of lingered on for me. Okay. I handed out some basic visuals. These are pictures that are drawn from Netter's textbook, which I have up here if you want to actually see the original somewhere along. And some of the drawings are also reproduced on the wall for those of you who might want to look later. I'm going to go through the aggregates, the skandhas, pretty much as Rick outlined them, starting with, the neuroanatomy that really underlies, remember, we're an organism we are material form, but we are looking out at material form, we are sensing material form, and how does that happen? So I'm going to walk through the five major senses, and kind of show you how the sensory systems take what you see as a unitary experience and deconstruct it into all kinds of different things. And then as it goes back up into the brain, it gets reconstructed. Now, you'll see pathways where it looks like sensations go from here to there, and stuff happens. One of the basic principles that I didn't put in the handout, but which I want to underscore, is that these pathways are axonal connections. These are fibers that go from one place to another. And the thing that actually happens is an electrical current going down that axon and a synapse and connections to the next set of neurons that's either excitatory or inhibitory. And there are lots of these connections, and this stuff is happening very fast. But what is represented in these pictures is not that there's some light somehow magically gets camerified to the back of your head, but actually in the back of your head is a whole electrical melange of activity that is representing electrically what's happening in your retina, or was representing electrically up in the sensory cortex what's happening in your foot or your face. And so that is not the reality that is out there. It is the electrical representation of that reality which the brain is creating. And I think that's an important point to talk about kind of all of this anatomy. So let's start with vision. As you can see there, the basic anatomy is that in the retina you have rods and cones. The rods are sort of the basic kind of black-white vision. That's that vision that's available to you in the dark when you kind of see this bluish tinge to everything. And you can kind of see things in shades of gray. Those are the rod vision. Cones are the color detection. Those are organized by ganglion cells in the retina. These project back into the optic nerves to the lateral geniculate in the brainstem. Then that goes from the optic radiations to the occipital cortex in the back of your head. So your mom was right, she does indeed have eyes in the back of her head. We, however, never inherited those, so we're stuck. Now, some ideas about physiology. There are 100 million rods to detect dim light, and they're spread throughout the retina. There are only 5 million cones, and they detect daylight vision and color. There are three different types. There's a type of cone that detects short wavelength light within our visual spectrum, one that detects middle wavelength light, and one that detects long wavelength light. To correlate that, long wavelength is red, short wavelength is blue, and yellow and green are kind of in the middle. Now, ganglion cells, the way that that structure in the retina is organized is by neighborhood inhibition. So if one set of neurons is firing, it inhibits its immediate neighbors. That's an important principle because if you think about it, that winds up as an edge detector. If you want to see an edge detection, on your handout, you'll see that the black border there. Okay. If you can find a really sharp edge to the black border, take a really close look at it. And what you will see is that the white right next to that sharp edge is a little whiter. And the black right next to that sharp edge is a little blacker. And what that is that the neurons that are receiving the white light, which are stimulated and firing at a rapid rate, are inhibiting the neurons right next to it, which are seeing the black side and not firing so fast. So what happens is that right next to the edge, you get a group of neurons that are actually firing much lower than the level would suggest. And right next to that in the white light, you're getting a group of neurons which aren't as inhibited, and they're firing a little faster. What that does is it makes you a good edge detector. The brain really needs to do that in terms of deciding where things end and where things start. So now that as this stuff projects and you get edge detectors and you get fields of perception in these ganglion cells, those edges and that sense of field of neurons that fire with a lot of light around them and none in the center, neurons that fire with a lot of light in the center and none of them around, that all goes back to the lateral geniculate, which organizes the data into some fine-grained color vision. There's a red-green spectrum and a blue-yellow spectrum of neurons that relate to those particular color distinctions. And then there's a sense of luminosity. Those are separate pathways. Red-green is one pathway. Blue-yellow is another pathway. And the whole sense of luminosity is the third. So you can see this is all of a sudden... things that you might think of as a unitary visual experience are starting to be broken up a lot in terms of the kind of signals that are being sent back, and we haven't even gotten to the cortex yet. Now, to give you an idea about how fast this is working, your eye is taking pictures, which you can see if you remember, if you've looked at fast-rotating things, occasionally you see segments. If you move your mouse around really fast on the CRT screen, you'll see it as little segments of the little arrows go point, 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 point as you go across. That's not the CRT screen. That's you. It's not that the CRT screen is doing. The CRT screen is functioning much faster than your retina. You're actually seeing the pictures that your eyes are taking, click, 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 as you move that mouse across.
You can move your finger across your eyes, and you don't have to be stoned to get the effect.
Right. But it helps. Both of us have experience. God, that goes way back. Yeah. Okay, I've got to move along. This is never going to be 25 minutes. Now, you take these pictures at 20 to, at somewhere between 20 to, between 5 and 50 pictures per second. So sort of like somewhere on the order of about 25 to 200 milliseconds per time slot. Depending on how there are feedback loops that control this visual perception, depending on how rapidly your vision wants to process. This is why, for example, we've used the example in the class before, when you are in a state of high arousal, Rick's example is falling off a rock, you process visual images, bop, 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 and you are aware of data happening very, very quickly. If you've been in an auto accident, you can watch things happen. It almost seems like millisecond by millisecond by millisecond. Well, what's happened is your brain has upgraded your visual processing and taken your clock time on your eye computer down so that you're processing 25 millisecond epochs. because it's critical for survival. It's one of the things that starts to happen in terms of feedback loops that go back from the cortex and modulate the eye movement. So there's somewhere on the order coming in on your optic nerves of about 10 million bits per second of visual information. That's a whole lot of data going on. Now, the cortex is going to process this, is going to be processing this data, but only 5% of the inputs to cortical visual cortical neurons in the occiput, only about 5% of the inputs happening in cortical neurons are from the optic nerves. 95% of what's going on in the occipital cortex is cortical processing, trying to figure out what all of this means and how we're going to assemble it and put it together. And interestingly enough, the Francis Crick and Christoph Koch published probably one of the initial papers on the gamma synchrony effect. And it turns out that if you're looking at the visual cortex, when the cortex decides what it is that it's seeing, there's a 40 hertz signal that starts to show up in a whole lot of the cortical neurons.
40 hertz means 40 times a second.
40 times a second. There's sort of this mutual oscillation signal that starts to happen, which speaks to what Dan was talking about in terms of his question of there not being any there. The whole cortex appears to start to resonate at this 40 hertz signal, and whatever's oscillating with that 40 hertz becomes what is seen. Okay. Now remember, you've neglected a lot of other stuff, and a lot of that 10 million bits is tossed out. So what you're seeing is not necessarily everything that's there. And there are lots of studies showing visual neglect. Pilots that are landing a 747 failing to notice that there's a small Cessna sitting on the runway. And this has been done over and over and over again in simulators where they flash a stimulus and you don't expect to see it, and you don't. It's literally present, and you run the tape back again. And you go, what the hell? Your expectations of what you're going to see determine some of what's going on. Now, out of that primary visual cortex and all that processing I was just talking about, there are two different pathways that emerge that have relationships to the rest of the brain. There's a vision for action path that comes from the occipital cortex up over through the parietal toward the frontal lobes. That's related to the position of whatever it is that you're looking at and whether or not we're supposed to do something about it. Is that an incoming spear or a falling banana? What am I supposed to do about that visual localization? And then there's a vision for perception path, which goes to the temporal lobes and into the frontal. And that is actually where visual consciousness starts to happen, because that, when we're talking in the aggregate meditation, when you label something visually, and if you meditate with your eyes slightly open and you're processing visual information, and you watch yourself visually label shoe or rug or fingernail, that visual labeling is that inferior pathway coming through the temporal lobes. And so that's where memory and identification happen. Now, some fun facts about this. The central one degree of vision is heavily overrepresented, so we move our eyes around a lot. We don't notice that we're moving. You block the saccade. And the brain will paint that in, and that vision is suppressed in the eye movements, which is why there's a great deal of difference between watching your kids play on the playground and watching the movie that you took of them on the playground, and as opposed to your memory of them playing, which was continuous, and they were having fun swinging back and forth. The movie is, it's totally jerky, and you get nauseous trying to watch it. And that's the difference between what your brain does for you, which is to smooth out that whole thing, and what's actually there when you record it in a digital framework. So that's sort of how one of the kind of the deconstruction in part of what vision does for you. There's a great book called The Quest for Consciousness by Christoph Koch, which actually is a 200-page tome on how he takes this apart. And for those of you who want to do some further reading, it's a great piece of work. The second sensation, hearing. Basically, our basic anatomy, the hair cells in the cochlea are squeezed between the basilar membrane and the tectorial membrane. The cochlea is organized by high tones, middle tones, and low tones. So again, here you get this differentiation into different signals representing different sounds. There's a lot of cross connections, which I'm going to skim right over right now because of the interest of time, in the brainstem on the way up. But in the brainstem, in a structure called the superior olivary complex, you start to establish the time delay between sound arriving at the left and right ear. So you start localizing a three-dimensional space, literally way down before you get to the cortex. And the signals that are starting to come up the brainstem represent a localization in time, or a difference in time, between left ear and right ear, which you are starting to localize as the sounds coming from this side or sounds coming from that side. And based on subtle changes in your head position during sound, you'll begin to process in front of or in back. So all of that starts to happen literally with signals, processing of signals in the brainstem before it ever shows up on the cortex. A major take-home point is that the bulk of neural activity from one ear winds up in the contralateral temporal lobe for processing. That's similar to the way the vision is located. Everything in your left visual field goes to your right occipital lobe. Everything in your right occipital field goes to your left, or right visual field goes to your left occipital lobe. And everything up goes down, and everything down goes up. The brain has got it totally bass-ackwards. So there's some interesting things that show up in terms of sound processing. Sounds can blend into each other and be misidentified. This really came home to me in a retreat up in Washington, which in the summertime, I'm sitting in a very hot room with flies. And I got this fly buzzing in my ear. And the fly moves away. And imperceptibly, and I was really watching this happen, imperceptibly, this moved into the sound of a diesel locomotive train moving down the valley with that, you know, that kind of quality. Because the fly just kind of drifted away, and the train sound came right through. And it was the same amplitude, frequency, and content. And I watched the feeling tone of that, from really being worried that somebody was about to lay an egg in my ear to oh, romantic, you know, journey off into the Orient Express kind of shtick. And I just kind of said, wow. The second thing is a cocktail party conversation phenomenon. You sit there in the middle of a cocktail party, and you can track somebody's voice with everybody else talking and cracking jokes in front of you and behind you. Interestingly enough, in certain kinds of cortical lesions, you can't do that. And in certain kinds of deafness, it's one of the problems that people have, because when you ramp up the amplification through the ear, you change that, and you're no longer able to comprehend it. And then a third sort of fun fact in there is that language, literal speech, taking this and cracking it into phonemes and morphemes and concepts, is done on one side of the brain. And cracking the prosodic quality of speech, the tone, the inflection, the melodic line, the emotional content of speech, is done on the totally opposite side of the brain.
The right hemisphere.
Yeah.
How does the lack of discrimination as you age in sound have to do with this? As you get older, as I got older, mm-hmm. I have trouble hearing dialogue in some movies.
That's right. Right. Cochlear neurons die. You have less range of dynamic sensitivity. And so you're trying to compress a tremendous amount of data into a smaller and smaller and smaller pipe. Essentially, less gets through. That's the metaphor. Sensation of smell. Let's move on to that. Basic anatomy. There are 100 million olfactory fibers. You don't think of that as being a major big deal, but that's almost as many as you have rods in your eyeballs. There's a lot of local circuitry and feedback inhibition, such that what's detected at the surface there, with the top of your nostrils, is chemical structure. It doesn't have the same sense of smell as you and I would as roses. And there's a real great book called The Emperor of Scent, which you can go get in Borders, which will help you read through some of this. This is, and it actually begins to break this down. Smell is actually a very complicated phenomenon. When you get out of that initial thing, there's a thing called the mitral cell, which you'll see referenced on your handout. The output of the mitral and tufted cells begin to resemble what we think of as smell, and when we think of the olfactory experience of roses, for example. One of the interesting things is that there's a lot of projections from smell into the amygdala, the cortex near the hippocampus, and the hypothalamus. Now, that's critically important because if you think about what we have been talking about in our day-longs and what we talked a little bit about last time, the amygdala is that initial feeling tone number to, you know, approach, avoid, you know, who cares, you know, positive, negative, or neutral. The hippocampus is a strong structure of, is the structure of memory. It's the thing that sort of helps you recall memories from the past. It's what helps you lay down memories. Interestingly enough, there's a recent Scientific American factoid out there. They did some studies on medical students trying to remember the game Concentration, and they sort of sent little puffs of rose scent while they were doing it, and then as they were sleeping that night during slow wave sleep, they puffed rose scent into these poor sleeping medical students. You know, at least they used choose roses. I could think of some other things they could do. The medical students' performance the next day on that concentration task, remembering where these locations were, and they hadn't seen that stuff in 12 to 15 hours, was tremendously improved. Slow wave sleep and smell somehow consolidated, and it's sort of this whole thing about smell is deeply ingrained into consolidating memories. And for example, for me, a cold gray day that's damp with the smell of diesel exhaust is Vienna, 1969, and I go right back there. And for some reason, my brain did that to me, and I can never escape it. So I'm just stuck. And in addition, there's a lot of very subtle, we talked about conscious behavior, but if you start thinking about being able to bring some of the subconscious into conscious awareness, think about what pheromones do. If you take substances from the sweat glands of women and paste them on the nostrils of other women, you will synchronize everybody's menstrual cycle. I mean, pheromones do that. Pheromones, there are all kinds of, for example, sexual attraction varies tremendously in terms of the pheromonic content of male sweat vis-a-vis whether or not a woman's ovulating, and there are really solid studies that show that. And so her response to males at a certain time of her cycle will be very different than her response to males later in the cycle. And there's another book by Matt Ridley called The Red Queen, which walks you through some of that data, which is scary to some of us. Y chromosome's a terrible thing. I'm going to skip taste. It's a little bit simpler. Basically, one of the little take-home points on taste is that what you and I think of as taste, of how what a Cabernet is like or what a chocolate chip cookie is like, is actually mostly smell. About 70 to 80% of that is smell. There are really only four sensations on the tongue: sweet, sour, salt, and bitter. That's it. Which is why when people get a concussion and tear off their olfactory bulbs, food becomes really boring. If you really want to get an idea of a neutral stimulus, talk to somebody who has lost their sense of smell about what it is like to eat cardboard and oatmeal. Body sensation. There's some real basic anatomy here that I'm just going to say there are really two different types of things. There is a posterior column system, goes up the back of the spinal cord, which is involved in discriminative touch or pressure, muscle length and tension, joint position, vibration. All of that dorsal column stuff is set up to mediate fine tactile and kinesthetic sensation. It's designed to tell you where you are in space and how you are moving. And then there's an anterolateral system, which has information about pain, temperature, coarse touch, and pressure. And basically that is, do I hurt or not? Okay? And what am I supposed to do about it? And there's a lot of dynamic control up and down through that system, and that involves both face and body, which may suppress sensation. pain suppression is an absolute fact. We suppress pain all the time. It's absolutely necessary. How's your tush doing? Okay? Now, until I said how your tush is doing, none of you were paying any attention to what was going on in your gluteus maximus and your ischial tuberosities. Okay? As soon as I said how your tush is doing, some of you are checking and saying, you know, that chair is a little hard. You know, you suppress that pain until I ask the question. You know, we suppress a lot of that incoming sensation until it's unless it's absolutely necessary and salient for us to do. And then there's subsequently also a visceral sensation, which is that gut feeling sense, and that comes in through the autonomic nervous system. Different set of inputs, and basically that's involved. You know, one of the interesting things, the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and parasympathetic, which we talked a lot about last time, is thought of as a motor control mechanism, but it's actually not true. 70% of that autonomic nervous system is incoming sensory experience. The brain really doesn't need to know a lot about that in a conscious level, but the spinal cord and brain stem need to know a lot about it, about what's going on internally in order to regulate stuff. The neuroanatomy of feeling, so let's get on to the next aggregate, the feeling aggregate, before I run into 10 o'clock and Rick strangles me. The feeling accurate. Basically, we already talked about that. The amygdala labels experience pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Now, I want you to kind of go back through the sort of handout slides and look at all of the pictures. And what you will see is that. There's a visual input to the amygdala. There's an olfactory, strong olfactory input to the amygdala. There are cross connections from the somatosensory input to the amygdala, and there are connections from the auditory input to the amygdala.
A good picture for the amygdala is on the taste pathways picture.
Right.
And you'll see that, just as Rick said, all these senses basically go to the amygdala. The amygdala is like a little traffic cop or crossing guard who's sticking up a flag. Green, yellow, or red all the time. You know, green, pleasant, yellow, neutral, red, unpleasant, right? And you can see the amygdala kind of in the upper picture on that taste pathway picture. See? Okay? Yeah. And you can follow it. And it, basically, it's right dead center in the middle of everything, and there are two of them. There's one on either side. But they're busy little creatures.
Now, interestingly enough, it turns out that the whole field of positive psychology was sort of a rebound. Everybody was focusing on the pain and suffering of experience. Interestingly enough, it turns out that the brain is probably hardwired in the same kind of fashion as psychology was initially. Most of what the brain is paying attention to is pain. There's a little bit about pleasure. Even the pleasure has an aspect of pain. I'll go into that in a second. And neutral almost doesn't exist in terms of how sensory experience shows up. Pain is a product of a stimulus that suggests actual or impending tissue damage. The term impending is important for those of us who are thinking about psychic pain and the way that we think about fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, and a number of other things which involve connections in the brain where there's actually no real damage going on, but there is tremendous ongoing pain experience. So, this stimulus activates these pain fibers. There's some, if you touch a hot stove, there are two different types. There's a myelinated one, which jerks your arm away from the hot stove. And then there's that unmyelinated fiber, which is the burning, aching thing that goes on for the next 3 hours. In that burning, aching thing, aching pain, the unmyelinated fibers, the autonomic nervous system gets activated. And that participates in regulating the organism's response to this actual or threatened damage. Heart rate alters, blood circulation alters. In things like complex regional pain syndrome, where somebody has pain, the blood vessels to that painful extremity can actually shut down to the point of gangrene. So this pain experience at the spinal cord level, this is not cortical, this is all the way down, can really make some major changes in the way the body is organized. There's an interesting thing. Pierre Anville said, pain puts a bodyguard, I think body-guard, in front of the house while you repair a broken window. So the whole thing is to stop whatever is happening so that the body can engage in reparative processes from that tissue damage. There's also a tremendous interaction between pain and depression. Depression makes pain worse. Pain makes depression worse. It's a feed-forward loop rather than a feedback loop. One of the reasons that it is so hard to break into the cycles of people who have really, really severe ongoing depressions. And that's also wired in. Pleasure is a little bit more complicated. It's actually not the opposite of pain. It's actually a different direction. It's the relief of an internally perceived imbalance. Hunger, thirst, sexual, sensual gratification come to mind. A lot of these behaviors are coordinated at a hypothalamic and limbic level. At a higher cortical level, it's sort of the forethought of how not to have this problem, the anticipation of a reward for behavior. That's pleasurable. And so that opening up seeks us to approach and attain. Neutral, I honestly don't think the neutral exists. I think it's actually the sensations are below the threshold of necessary avoidance or the cost of pursuit for attainment.
Isn't this incredible? I mean, I could listen to Rick doing this for a long time, but then we wouldn't get out of here till 10 o'clock. And so we thought that it would be good to just take what we've said as illustrative of the incredible complexity and magnificence of what we've inherited right here, right now, tonight. Okay, so now let's open it up for a little discussion, because the rest of it's right there for you to read.
Right, it's all, pretty much all the rest of it is in the handout, and a lot of what I was going to go through is there. So, go.
Yeah, I'd like to hear, we've heard about the five senses, and I've also heard about animals in the tsunami went for high ground. Dogs barked 6 hours before an earthquake. What are animals, what are they using as a sense to pick up something that we can't do? Is it vibration? Is it sounds?
Honestly, it's not, for right now, because first, the question is about animals having sensations prior to the tsunami and going to higher ground. Dogs and other animals having premonitory sensations prior to earthquakes. Some of that is that we don't know. It's difficult. If you can run an experiment about that, you could perhaps start to understand this. But these are sporadic events. You don't have the monitoring equipment in place. We're just beginning to understand that the communication of elephants, for example, is in sound so low that 2 and 3 and 4 hertz, but that the strength and intensity of those sounds is like 60, 70 decibels, so that they can talk 10 miles distance at frequencies we don't hear. So that's difficult to know. And so at this point, what I would say is to have don't know mind about it, which is to say, on the best available data, no conclusions can be drawn. Interesting question. Later on, if there are ways to run an experiment and analyze it, maybe we will know more. Yeah?
Well, part of that's retrodictive, too. You see something, see if they move, and then that particular thing, you pay attention because the earthquake happened. But they also move when there's no earthquake.
Could be. That's again where, when you're looking at sporadic events, it's impossible to run a controlled experiment to analyze what exactly might be happening there.
But I think that the thing to really kind of feel into is not the details, because the details can be overwhelming.
Yeah.
Right. The thing to get. It says, what's going on right now and what you're aware of is constructed by the body
right. In
all these amazing ways. Right. And that actually, it's like right now you are mindful of the body, right?
Yeah.
But what is it that's being mindful?
The body.
It's the body. It's the body doing this incredible thing.
Right.
That's been built up over millions and millions of years, about 450 million years of multi-cell organisms. Right? It's the body. It's the body that's mindful of the body. It's all one thing. Mm-hmm. Right? And there can be often a kind of kathunk where we settle into the peacefulness of that. And we realize that, as all the great teachers have said, don't leave the body behind. Be embodied in the body. And through the embodiment of the body, you see the great teaching that it's all just streaming by.
The other,
and the neurological part is what informs that. It's a means to the end of that takeaway.
Right.
None of us are going to go here tonight and do brain surgery, except maybe Rick. But, you know, see what I mean? The takeaway is that deeper takeaway toward inner peace.
The other riff I actually wanted to go through and sort of lay out tonight is actually in that neuroanatomy of mental formations. Because that, for me, is really the interesting piece. The emotional, the volitional, and intellectual aspects of any experience, biologically and scientifically now, can be seen as a result of the combination of the genetic loading of the organism at conception. You inherited a set of DNA. It's going to build a brain of a particular type with particular neurotransmitters and particular connections. The biological progress and development of that nervous system through embryogenesis and development up until this moment. Okay, not just the development as you grow up and became an adult, but there's development, you know, just as Erickson pointed out, there's development all the way through the cycle, and that's actually programmed in. And then the experientially determined behaviors and memories of that organism. All of that stuff biases the organism to perceive and react to external and internal stimuli in a particular way, whether it's the banana on the table or the PTSD experience of loud noises imitating Iraqi IEDs. That, honest to God, is probably the best biological definition of karma I've ever seen. I mean, you inherited karma. It's the DNA of the organism. You go back, everybody in this room, you go back 60,000, you go back 140,000 years, we got the same mom or the same dad somewhere in Africa. We can now trace the chromosomal inheritance of all of us back to pretty close to a single woman, single man, you know, not that many generations ago. So, you know, this human life, this incarnation, this random assortment of genetic material is, you know, it's biologic karma. And then you take it and you plop it into Marin County. You know, we did something right. And on that, I think I'll sit down.
Any more comments or questions? Do you buy this? I mean, in a funny way, it's hard to... We think of our experience as seamless, right?
Mm-hmm.
As one whole integrated thing. And in a way, we're speaking from an ancient contemplative tradition as well as a very modern neurological tradition to deconstruct,
right,
you know, the picture. It's like you see these pictures of a cathedral. It looks like a cathedral, but when you get closer, it's made of 1,000 little photographs,
mm-hmm,
right? And each one of those photographs is made of 1,000 little pixels, little dots. Right, it's like that. We're kind of deconstructing the picture of the cathedral that comes to us. All right. So, do you buy this? Do you have any challenges to it, or any questions about it? Yeah.
Well, even when you have your own experience of it, as you sometimes do, like when you're driving and you see something in the road and you think it's a cloth, and mm-hmm, then it's a snake, and then it's a rope, and then it's a God knows what. So, even when you are doing that, you know your brain is constructing all of that. It's very hard to stay with that awareness because our habit makes us go back to like watching the movie.
Right. And that thing about it being hard to stay with that. The important thing for me is not to stay moment by moment by moment by moment in the immediacy of all of this being constructed and all of these different sensory modalities and all of this happening. That's impossible. What the real critical piece is the liberation from the things that cause you suffering. It's the fact that this is just causes and conditions, and that this was put together through your genetic and experiential karma into this moment, sitting here in this room, and whatever it is that you're suffering, there is in this the freedom that there is a path out. That this thing actually is not real, okay, and that it is compounded, it is constructed, and you can, with careful attention, deconstruct it, disassemble it, and you can take the little shack and build Chartres Cathedral out of it, if you want to, if you're willing to spend that time. And part of that is just not taking this reality so seriously. I mean, because it is. All of those pixels of that cathedral, you know, and all the little pictures of all the little human beings that are used to make up that cathedral. I mean, it's fascinating to me that Manet and Seurat literally did this 100 years ago. When you look at what they did with light, and how they just exercised light. I mean, they did Dharma. They did visual Dharma. And we take that and you look at a Seurat painting, you know, Sunday in the Park with George. And you see a picture of a whole bunch of people, and they get up really close, and it's just little dots of color. Well, it turns out that's actually what the paint does. They're little blobs of color representation in the way that the retina responds to color, and it paints things in. All of the visual illusions that you see out there now are part of that.
Andy.
In some ways, are the spiritual practices meant to, in a sense, reconstruct the hardware that experiences and then reconstruct the experience? I mean, it's not just a matter of deconstruction, is it? If you can talk about the thickening of the brain, the training the neurons to fire a certain way, you're almost...
Right. Yeah.
It is a postmodern.
Yeah, 2,500 year postmodern tradition.
Modern is sort of deconstructed and postmodern is sort of deconstructed.
Yeah. Julian?
But also, I think that although the deconstruction is essential, if you look at, for instance, Chinese painting, you see a level of aesthetics about feeling states that is in homage to the sort of totality of the percept that the person has. And being able to hold that opens you to the very subtle gradations and shadings of experience. So I'm making the case for both deconstruction and elaboration of construction as well as giving a balance, because both are true for us.
Right. Oh. I think bottom line at the base, when you've completely deconstructed it, and you're actually in the moment, there's that completely different spiritual experience, which in the Tibetan practices is referred to as shamatha, and in the contemplative Christian prayer tradition is, you know, oneness with Christ. There's this fusion, there's this real deep awareness of what it is to be moment by moment by moment alive, what it is to be aware. At the end of our first guided meditation, we're going to have to, well, we'll take Jai's question and then we've got to move on to, because we have a guided meditation at the end.
But I want to take your question too.
Okay, so we got two questions. All right, two questions and then move on. But at the end of that first meditation, we flipped it and be aware of awareness. You know, Ajahshanti does a whole thing on being aware of being aware. Get yourself be aware of there's somebody being aware, and then turn around to look at who that is, or what that is, or is that is. And that sense of emptiness in there is, I think, a very, very, very deep freedom. Because that's actually probably, in the Buddha's experience, and I think verified by a number of other people in all kinds of different religious traditions, that's actually the thing that's secure. And it's a piece of nothingness that's absolutely secure, which is really hard to hang on.
Jai.
What you're saying seems to imply that consciousness is dependent on the body, but what about what happens to consciousness when the body dies?
Okay, so Jai's question was the $64 question.
Yeah.
Was basically, we're talking about the bodily construction of consciousness, and he's saying what happens to consciousness when the body dies and so forth. Really quickly, Rick and I are theists in the sense that of all the three possible positions, you know, atheist, there is no transcendental. Theist, there is something transcendental. Agnostic, I'm not sure. All right, either way, right, we're theists. Having said that, we are relentlessly focused on the material realm because that's where we all have common ground. And who knows? It is humbling to appreciate how vulnerable the noggin is and how important it is to take good care of it. Mm-hmm. You know, because literally consciousness changes. I mean, if any of us have had aging parents who lose cognitive function or have known anyone with a head injury, or if you just simply observe the vulnerability of consciousness to drugs or, you know, internal drugs, if you will, nutrients of different kinds, pressure,
blood sugar,
it's pretty vulnerable. So other than that, we're going to deliberately duck that question.
Actually, it's not ducking it. No available data.
Well,
really, honest to God, no available data, lots of hunches, and just like trying to figure out how the animals react to an earthquake, you know, every one of us will have that experience. It will be a tremendous adventure to go through that door. But I have no data on this side of that door that really helps inform me as to what happens there.
I'll indulge myself by saying I had a spiritual teacher for a while, Adi Da, Da Frijon, and he had a saying that everyone becomes a mystic on their deathbed. Why not start now? You know, that was his line. Did you want to say something or not? So, yeah, please. But what do you mean by transformation? Is transformation possible?
Yeah, what do I mean? I know that I've read that DNA can change. Your very DNA, it's not like it's just set, completely set, right? You're born, you die with exactly the same DNA.
The DNA changes in each dividing cell because the duplicative mechanism that creates a new DNA strand from the first DNA strand is not 100% accurate. So it does change. In addition, the transmitter, the DNA coding for the various proteins that organize the brain's neurotransmitter systems change as we get older. Your serotonin receptors at age 10 are not your serotonin receptors at age 40 or 60 or 90. And we know that's the case. So there is a tremendous amount of actual biologic transformation that's in the system.
And also gene expression switches genes
out. Right. That's exactly what I was talking about, Julian. So there is biological transformation. Is transformation possible from the standpoint? Okay, now let me do one quick thing, because there is a potential error in here, which is the Lamarckian question. Can you redo your DNA such that you have a different organism? Can learned experience influence the genetic inheritance of your offspring, say, for example? And the answer to that, probably from biology, is a profound no. However, can you transform your personal experience in the context of what you inherited and what your experience was through your life? Absolutely. Always available. That, I think, is what I was talking about in terms of the freedom of deconstructing, is that if you actually follow all of that stuff down, the terrible shit that your mother did to you when we were 4 years old is potentially transformable. We were having a conversation with somebody in the break. Ted Bundy came from a very, very banal family. Sociopath, 40, 60 women slaughtered all over the Western United States. Okay, Nelson Mandela spent 25 years in Rikers Island. Okay? He comes out practically a saint. You know, what is the difference? I mean, you take a particular genetic constellation, you throw it into particular kinds of experience. There is that potential to transform and to make something out of anything. That I think is, you know, is from biology at this point, an actual truth. Almost a dicta.
Well, I think it's
is
the.
Is it just letting go? I guess that's the.
I think it's the question in the. It's the question in the room. And, so, it's the question in the room, right? It's the one we've been asking, and three part answer. Part one, there is a lot of value in the feeling people have of almost alienation or disenchantment with experience. There is a little despair, right? It's uncomfortable. That's part of what's driving the questions that are popping up here. You know, it's uncomfortable to look at experience in this way, is it not? We tend to idolize or privilege our experience, me, 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 and it's kind of uncomfortable to just think of it with some disenchantment as just a pile of collected elements coming and going, ho-hum. But on the other hand, that disenchantment is a great pathway into, you know, freedom from the suffering that comes from getting all caught up in our experience, part one. Part two, in terms of transformation, all the great teachers and all the wise people any of us, I think, have ever known talk about the cultivation of good qualities. Part of what enables what the compounded nature of experience gives us is exactly what Rick said, a fantastic opportunity to compound new and more wholesome qualities within ourselves, to cultivate the good and develop the good within ourselves. That is transformative. You know, the accumulation of growing goodness and the endless letting go of what's not so wholesome or happy. That's part two.
And then possible is not easy, though.
No, it's long-term practice. There's tremendous evidence for the benefits of long-term practice of all kinds. In small ways and large, those things accumulate over time. I mean, we've all ourselves probably become quite different people than we were 30 years ago, you know, or even 3 days ago or 3 months ago. So, okay, cultivation. And the third part answer is that what's very interesting is that when you endlessly deconstruct the mind, what's left? Is what's left mean and nasty? No. What everyone always discovers is awareness that's naturally, innately present, interested, benign, and wise. And that's the ultimate floor that the deconstructed orientation to life drops us into again and again and again. That's the good news. It's not a void, but it's radiant love consciousness. Yeah. That's the good news. And on that note, we are going to have a little meditation at the end. And Rick's going to lead.
Okay. I need the bell.
And we'll end on this meditation.
So, let's start by taking a few minutes here to reflect on the extraordinariness of the body, this embodied heart-mind, including how that reflection is something the body and the heart-mind is itself doing right now. So see if you can bring a sense of wonder and appreciation, perhaps gratitude, to your own body and all that it does for you as you. Perhaps imagine that the body is standing before you and you are thanking it, seeing it clearly. All its burdens, its sorrows, its joys, its accomplishments, its structure, its function. And take a second to thank it. Thank you, body, for being me, supporting me. And now let's shift our attention to a deepening awareness of the aggregates as we've come to understand them tonight, streaming through our attention. Awareness of this body breathing. Being at one with this body, breathing. becoming aware of a peaceful sense of simply being a body, sensing here. One sensation or another, followed by another. Perhaps simply a body feeling here. Pleasant? Unpleasant? Neutral? And then simply a body perceiving here. What do I call that? Why do I call that? And a body producing mental formations here. Memory. Emotion. Story. And simply a body producing conscious awareness. This too, this too. Witness that flow of experience changing endlessly. Just let it be. Let it be all that it is. No clinging. No reaction, no guidance. Just watch all these aggregates, these piles coming and going. Not inherently happy. Not inherently unhappy. Just what they are. None of it is me. None of it is mine. comes and goes. And awareness encompasses it and sits in the center. And witnesses. May we be safe from inner and outer danger and harm. May our minds be calm and clear. May our hearts be peaceful and loving. May we be happy. May we be healthy. May we awaken and be free. May we know love and joy and wonder and wisdom in this life, just as it is. And may the merit of our practice this evening be to the benefit of our body, heart, minds, those of our families, our friends, those we don't know, and extend out to all beings in all realms, that they too may come to freedom. May it be so.
We'll stick around for a few minutes. And if you haven't signed in or given us your email address, please do that and grab some M&Ms out the door. Wish you well. Our next class will be vastly less intellectual. It'll really be about an emotional celebration and commitment to this singular and precious life each of us have and how to really work with that as the foundation for all good things. So I hope to see you then. Thank you.